experimental results coming out, and it's a bit, they're a little bit hidden, because in a sense they are negative results, but they are very surprising, and the great surprise is a lack of surprise, because everybody was expecting surprises, right? There have been a lot of hype about finding the Higgs, which is a great result, obviously, but the hype was hiding the fact that everybody at CERN was expecting to find something else beyond the Higgs. And I was at CERN a few years before and talked with the people, with the theoreticians there, with the people, and I remember a lot of conversation, one with a very good friend of mine, who said, look, Carlo, it's sure, we're going to find supersymmetry immediately. As soon as we turn the LHC on, we'll find supersymmetry. There are too many indications from it. Dark matter, strings, supersymmetric minimal models, and this, naturality, and this is all this list of things. So it's certain. We turn that out on the LHC, and we find supersymmetry. Supersymmetry, low-energy supersymmetry is not there where it was expected. I think this is nature saying something, and we should take it. A lot of alternative models, like minimal supersymmetric models, are more or less ruled out for the moment. Similarly with Planck, I mean, a lot of people expected a big deviation from what we knew previously. They didn't. In a sense, Planck confirmed the standard model, cosmological standard model picture, to a remarkable degree. It also confirmed that inflation, something like inflation, something that does the same job as inflation, is likely to have happened. But all a large number of fancy inflation models are already ruled out by Planck. So nature, what is nature telling us? It's telling us that, in fact, we knew about the world better than what we thought, I think, we knew. That the standard model is correct to more than it was always been assumed, and the generativity is correct more than it was always assumed. Obviously, not finding low energy supersymmetry does not disprove string theory, clearly, right? Because supersymmetry may exist at higher energy, or whatever. Nevertheless, I think I'm totally honest. I have written this. If supersymmetry would have come out immediately, turning out LHC, I would have had more doubts on what I'm doing and what many people here are doing. Because in a sense, string theory needs supersymmetry. And it's part of a view of the world where it would say, nature saying, look, those people are in the right track, okay? And nature is not saying that. And in fact, a lot of people who are going around with big smiles saying, okay, we are the supersymmetry guys, we're now gonna win. No, I mean, they are now going with sad faces. There is an example, this is not my idea, I got from something else, in which something similar happened with the Maxwell equation. So when Maxwell wrote the equation, it was an immense success, spectacular success. But Maxwell was the first to say, okay, these are just phenomenological equations, there's physics beyond them. Down there is some mechanical thing that is pushed and pulled and some, so there is, you know, it's like, it's just phenomenological, like the Einstein equation, just phenomenological, they're just emerging from something else, right? And so there was a search for that, for this, and it was not found. And at some point, somebody like Michelson and Morley started searching, and between the first experiment of them is 87 all the way to 1905, there was a great surprise. And the surprise was no surprise at all. I mean, the Maxwell equation are correct. You don't see the motion of the Earth with respect to the ether, to the background. What was the message then? Well, take the theory that you have seriously. Maxwell equations, which were found in a laboratory, actually are good from atomic scale, or even more, to galactic scale. A good description of physics. Doesn't mean that they're the final theory, doesn't mean that generativity is the final theory, but it's extraordinarily effective, and the best bet we have until we find contrary experimental results is that what we know about nature is likely to hold more far away. So I think a lot of the attempt to just disregard what is specific about GR, in my opinion, have not received any sort of hint from nature recently the other way around. And therefore, trying to do non-perturbative general relativity looks increasingly more as a good idea. In fact, this idea is receiving more attention also from people outside this community here. And as I like to say, there is a well-defined way of posing the problem, which is there a quantum theory whose classical limit is general relativity? right? It's almost a well-defined mathematical problem, and that's I view as the sort of the general context in which we are working. So this was the what nature is telling us. What about this conference? Now I'm going to pick a few things which I consider particularly impressive coming out from this conference. The list is a little bit arbitrary. I'm sure is far from being complete. But these are things which I think were not there 2 years ago at the Madrid conference. And and for me are a sign of progress. And I think the list of this shows how much the field is moving fast. First of all, I've seen predictions about what we might be able to see in the CMB if as soon as we get a little bit more precision. Now, these predictions are not conclusive enough. Conclusive, I would like to have predictions such that if a phenomenon is not found, is a counterindication for the theory, right? That's what we need. Of course, we are in a weak situation, like the string theories, right? What we always blame the string theories for, we're in the same situation. We make predictions such that if it doesn't happen, we say, well, it was not really a prediction. But we do what we can, like the string theories, they do what they can. And so the prediction we have about the sort of large angle part of the CMB power spectrum are not yet so strong because they depend on a parameter which we don't control, and so they might still, if this tilt in the power is not found, it doesn't mean that the theory is wrong, which is bad. We need prediction that. But nevertheless, we have equations for early cosmology. We have a way for computing from fundamental theory all the way to observables. I think this is a huge step ahead, and there is a field there which is wonderful. Second thing, which I found particularly impressive, Mushin hasn't stressed this very much, but the Q deformed spinform amplitudes are finite. A finite at all order in an expansion, and they're all finite. This is not a small thing for me, because we have a tentative theory of quantum gravity. It might be wrong, might be inconsistent, but it's there. There's a family of transition amplitudes, those ones, which are well-defined, finite, and it's an infinite number of there. It's like having the Weitmann function of a quantum field theory. Now let's study them. Maybe there is GR inside. There are a lot of indication that there is GR. Maybe not, because there's something wrong in them. Good. That's, we want to find it as soon as possible if there's not GR inside there. Maybe they're inconsistent, because they don't pile up consistently. I'll come back to that. Or maybe they are consistent, but there is a theory. A theory meaning a well-defined, complete, a quantum field theory, you can define it giving all its transition amplitudes, all its endpoint functions. Here you don't have endpoint functions because of diff invariance. You cannot go into in space. So there is an object, complicated, rich mathematical object, which all possibly all physics inside, well-defined, and let's study them, I would say. Let me go back to the list. The third thing which I found completely different than 2 years ago is what we understand about black hole. There was a lot understood in quantum gravity about black hole. Okay, there was all the calculation that show summing on the punctures that we can get to a finite entropy, that the discreteness, the fundamental discreteness does imply a finite entropy, and this can be computed. The calculation were rich and nice and beautiful. There was always something strange because of the dependence of the Mirzi parameter, and somehow the desire to understand it in some way. What is it that fixes the Mirzi parameter there? It's just that magically the theory that it is there, or there's how does this work exactly? And I think there is more understanding of that. There's much more understanding of that, and a lot of this understanding came from a simple idea to look at the family, the family of the observers that we saw in Alejandro talk, and do the thermodynamics near the horizon. And if you do thermodynamics near the horizon, there is a beautiful set of results. In the quantum theory, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, what is happened to be the proper Hamiltonian for those family of observer, turn out to be precisely a quantity, which is a classical quantity, which depend on the Einstein equation, that give the energy seen by this observable there. So this is a calculation in the full non-perturbative quantum theory, in the very small. A similar calculation, which I'm not skipping here, shows that there is a temperature associated to this, which is Unruh temperature. A is, little a is the acceleration that this family observable distance L from the horizon keep, so is A is 1 over L. This gives immediately the 4, right? The 4 is simply 8 pi g divided by 2 pi, as many people have noticed before. And this is a consistent picture of what happened there. And Alex has a story that relates this with a previous calculation. This, I think, is a coherent picture coming around. We have heard how this temperature can be understood in terms of entanglement entropy across the horizon. There are a lot of things which are clarifying. My understanding, at least, of what is happening in black hole entropy has completely changed with respect to years ago. It's far from obvious that we're at the end of the story. I think this was addressed in the parallel sessions. The exact relation between the summing of the puncture, the degrees of freedom, the quantum degrees of freedom on the horizon itself, and the entanglement entropy is sort of intuitively comprehensible, but not worked out cleanly in our mathematics, and this has to be understood, has to be clarified. I think there is still work to do. There's a lot of results on which to build. This is a field in which I think the things are changing very fast. Something which was not existed at all in the context of spin forms is a beginning of calculating radiative corrections. I've been willing to do that for years and years. Finally, now they're coming out, thanks to building up of techniques for many, many people. And I'll come back, what is the relevance of this for understanding the usefulness of that family of functions. One thing that has come from all over, from string theory, like from canonical theory, from spin form quantum gravity, is the role of twisters. The role of twisters, primarily as technical tools, it's becoming obvious in all contexts. This is a Roger Penrose typical page of explaining what twisters are. The role of twisters conceptually is not clear, and it hints strongly that there is something about the causal structure that in spin form and in spin networks we are not fully appreciating. And in some sense, I think what our friends in causal dynamical triangulation and causal sets are telling us, and we should listen, is that the microscopic role of causal structure is more important than what is coming out in LQG. And this is a thing that I would like before the next conference to be more clarified. And then I've added this morning, because it was completely impressive that this results on dynamical reduction. So I just wanted to add it to my list of most interesting things. Let me say something about the various approaches, before going to some more specific issue. In my opinion, what sort of 40 years of research in quantum gravity have clarified, and the central point on which all the previous results build, black hole entropy, finiteness of quantum field theory, specific way of doing quantum field theory in a general covariant background and everything, is based on the realization, on the idea that what we are doing when we do quantum gravity is the theory of a fundamental length. This is what quantum gravity is about. Like special relativity is the theory of a maximal velocity. Like quantum mechanics is the theory of a minimal action. Action measures the information. Action is volume in phase space, so it's how much you know about the system. So if you want, it's a theory of minimal information, if you like this. And quantum gravity is the theory in which you realize that there is a minimal length. If you ask an experimental in, working at CERN on experiments, what is renormalization? His answer is, well, it's just a way of taking care of the fact that some down there, probably Planck scale, there's a finite scale, and that things are finite. Quantum gravity is a concrete realization of this intuition from many hand-on physicists. Of course, this discreteness is complicated. Maybe a quantum discreteness, maybe that's what we're trying to understand from the various point of view. But that's what quantum gravity is. It's the theory of... of course, this is, I think, what distinguishes approaches to quantum gravity. We used to distinguish approaches to quantum gravity as background-dependent one and background-independent one. I think there is a more fundamental distinction, which is the ones that are built on this fundamental scale, which can come out in different manners. In causal set, it's just postulated, assumed. Let's imagine that there are these discreteness as there. In loops, it just come out as from the discreteness of the spectra of the geometrical operator. So it's the same kind of discreteness of the harmonic oscillator energy. In strings, it come out in an contorted way, because there's all these degrees of freedom. When you try to grow in the small, instead of testing more and more small, you open up, the string open up to the other degrees of freedom. But also there is finiteness, right? String theory and loop quantum gravity are finite. There is no infinite renormalization, which doesn't mean there is no renormalization group. Of course there's a renormalization group. Of course there's a scaling from Planck scale to macroscopic. But there's no scaling from Planck scale down to smaller distances. That's it. It's like condensed matter away from a phase transition. There is an atomic scale, and then you study what happens at higher scale. But there is an atomic scale with a scale, and the scale influences the thickness of matter, what you compute at macroscopic scale. This is a completely different picture than the one of standard quantum field theory, of QED and QCD, where you do the opposite. You assume that you put a scale with a cutoff, and then you want the theory to exist for a cutoff going to zero. But I think that the core of quantum gravity is exactly going away from that picture. So this is what I think distinguishes two different set of ways of looking of quantum gravity. This doesn't mean that there is an issue about what is called the continuous limit in quantum gravity. But continuous, let me try to put my finger, and just slightly more technical, let me show you in which sense the cutoff disappears in quantum gravity. It's an extremely simple sense. This is the harmonic oscillator action. This is a discretization of the harmonic oscillation action, harmonic oscillator action. A is the lattice step. Now, you all know, because everybody does quantum gravity one day or the other, know that you can rewrite this in terms of a parameter and have a theory with two variables, which still has 1 degree of freedom and 1 constraint, right? So this is a parametrized form of that. It's exactly the same physics. Now, discretize this one. This is the discretization. And look, magic, 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 A disappears completely. A disappears. Of course, the limit here, if you want to recover the limit, the sum here has to go to infinity, but the Lagrangian doesn't have a scale. Now, here you can absorb the scale, of course, into omega, and then you can say that the limit is obtained by taking the sum to infinity and omega to a critical point. So every time you're doing a discretization of a normal system, you have to go to a critical point to recover the theory. That's why, for instance, causal dynamical triangulation, you need a second order phase transition because your individual object have to be taken infinitely small. But if you do a proper discretization of a parametrization invariant system, the scale disappears and the only limit you have to take is n going to infinity. That's what distinguish regi calculus from lattice QCD, for instance. That's what distinguish a proper discretization of general relativity that uses this from a discretization of a standard theory. Now, once you go to the quantum theory, if you take this action here, you make a path integral, you only have to take the n going to infinity limit and not, there is no A here to scale. So the only thing you have that. There is a scale in the theory, but the scale in the theory, look, this is a harmonic oscillator. This is a scale in the theory. The scale comes with an h-bar, right? Because the energy there so this is not, the absence of A doesn't mean that the theory is scale invariant. The harmonic oscillator is not scale invariant. This is a finite scale. Quantum gravity is not scale invariant. There is a scale there. But it's a physical scale. It's a physical finite scale. Now, if you actually take this and you do it explicitly, you put it in a computer, this is easily to compute, you discover two things. First, that this is the propagator of the harmonic oscillator that we can compute analytically, obviously, very simply. And this is a formula which is correct. But it's more than correct. If you take n equal 2 or 3, it converges very rapidly to that for almost all regimes, so for almost all Q and T. Except unless you go to Q and T particularly bad, it's sufficient to take n equal 3, and you get a very good approximation to that. I didn't want to bore you with graph. So in other words, this can be computed as a continuous limit of that, but you don't need to go to the continuous limit to have a good approximation of that. Okay? Why? Because you see, when n increases, you have more and more steps. This is a classical solution of the harmonic oscillator. Suppose you're computing the amplitude going from here to here. Then there are more and more points, so the trajectory here, it's flat from one step to the other. And when the trajectory is flat, let me go back one, the discretized term in the Lagrangian is exactly the Hamilton function of the flat theory. So what happened is that the theory trivializes when you have more and more points. I've called this Ditt invariance from Bianca Dittrich, because Bianca has various years, in fact, that is focusing on what's happening in this limit here. So for large n, the physical trajectory is nearly flat, and when it's nearly flat, this becomes genuinely independent of n going to infinity, right? So the question was, one of the young people is, what keeps you out at night? What keeps me out at night is that, is the same happening in quantum gravity? If the same is happening in quantum gravity, then this family of transition amplitudes define a theory such that when you increase the triangulation, the amplitude doesn't change, refine the triangulation, the amplitude stops changing at some point. Stop changing because you refine, you go to a flatness region where whatever you do. Now, of course, the fact that it happened for harmonic oscillator doesn't mean that it happens for quantum gravity, obviously, right? So that's why you stay up at night, otherwise you would sleep. So this, to me, is one of the key open questions in the, at least in the covariant approaches to quantum gravity, and is the core of understanding if there is if the finiteness hold in the limits. Of course, near flatness in general relativity we have gauge symmetries. So how do gauge symmetries enter the special gauge symmetries? Bianca again has studied them. How does this affect there? Does this create extra infinities that we have to deal at, or as the, oh, okay. Now let me say something, because this has raised a lot of confusion, I think. Suppose you have an electron, and this is a charge. An electron moves and has this trajectory. You want to compute it with Feynman diagrams, we compute that. Does the electron do that? No, of course. Suppose we have to study a proton, and we use lattice QCD. Now, I ask the people doing lattice QCD, what is a lattice, what is the number of cells you need to do this computation? And the answer from my friends who do lattice QCD, who compute actually the mass of the proton, the mesons, is, well, it's very easy. You take the size of the proton, you divide by the characteristic size of a quark, and you get a number, which is 20, and then your lattice spacing is 20. You don't need more than that. More than that is wasted computer power. Okay, you get the message. You don't need to refine the lattice infinitely. Suppose you want to study the universe. Well, we use the Friedman metric, okay? Is this equal to that? No, of course, okay? Is this good for describing the, yes, enormously good. Suppose, you know the story, right? The Canadian, so I'll skip the story. So if we want to describe the large scale structure, the large scale dynamics of something, we may use some drastic approximation, and the message here is, do not confuse a calculation tool with a picture of reality, right? A Feynman graph is not a picture of reality. The electron doesn't do that. So a calculation in spin form is a calculation tool, And if you use it at low order in a graph, in a vertex expansion, doesn't mean that you're describing a defined structure of space-time with big object. It only means that you are approximating let me skip this because I think you forget the message. I want to make a comment here. In spin form one always uses both analogies with Feynman graph and lattice QCD. And in a sense, it seems contradictory. But what I like about this theory is exactly that if you think a moment, quantum gravity is exactly bringing the two pictures together. Because here is a Feynman graph is a history of quanta of the field. Now, in gravity, the quanta of the field are pieces of space-time. So the lattice itself is a history of quanta of fields, right? So once you take diff invariance into account, a lattice becomes a Feynman graph. And this is what's happening in spin form. So where is the problem of the limit? There are sum of a large J, which can be give large terms, and there is, when you refine the triangulation, a contribution for large triangulation. The question is a vertical approximation a good approximation or not? And if it is, in which regime? Does a finer cellular decomposition give a different result? Do radiative corrections destroy the good classical limit? Here, I think, is where the covariant version of quantum gravity hinges. If this goes wrong, that's wrong. We have to do something else, in my opinion. Now, in the last two minutes, a few other issues. Other things that I already said that. I think that in spin form, there is something that is missing, which is the role of the causal structure down there. It's not that there is no causal structure, but it should play a role, and I think we haven't understood it yet. So this is something I would like before next conferences to come in. We have heard from Frank that there seem to be constraints in curvature in the J infinity limit. This is also something that has to be understood. I think that Frank and Wojciech have raised an interesting issue and other people in that. I do not think that this is the right limit. I mean, if one takes a generic too complex generic boundary condition and take J equal infinity, one can show in model cases that one goes in the wrong direction. Nevertheless, and in fact, if you look at the poster out there, there is a poster by Barrett and Oliveira, which shows concretely that once you do a calculation on a finite, too complex, the hypotheses of the theorem are contradicted, so they don't get flatness. Nevertheless, there is something to be understood here. And I think I would like this to be fully clarified before next. What really keeps me out at night, however, and I cannot say that, is thermodynamics. I do think, and in fact, some of my last papers are on that, I do think that we do not have a consistent definition of statistical mechanics and thermodynamics in a general covariant context. I've tried to work, other people have tried to work on that, a number of ideas, thermal times, et cetera, some have been presented in this conference. To me, it's a completely open issue, and which is interesting not because just by itself, but because it's intertwining with quantum gravity in a subtle way and profound way, I think. I think what the boundary formalism that we use in quantum gravity tell us that, in a sense, we're always in a statistical situation, and this is a large, dark, or white space to be filled. So, let me go. This is my last transparency. I try to summarize my emotions at the end of the conference, so to say. I'm impressed by how fast it's developing the field. I mean, I was at this series of loop conferences. What is a problem 1 year, it's a solution 2 or 4 years later. This has been happening for years after years, and somehow we don't, in the middle of the research, we don't appreciate that. But if you look at there are a lot of things, how do we compute that? This is impossible. How do we do that? This is impossible. And then these things are solved. This is incredible. I mean, so there is a rapidly expanding field. Nevertheless, and I would add that the hints are in favor, even if that doesn't need to be repeated all the time. Nature hasn't given us any yes yet. The main questions for me that remain open are whether the DIT invariance is realized, whether we actually have a consistent theory that give us a converging, in a weak sense, expansion, to which extent we can make stronger the calculation of physical effect. I'm puzzled by this dimensional reduction I just heard, so I just added this now, and the generativistic thermodynamics. And what I really hope, and in fact I'm confident, that the next conference there will be sections on that and will be solutions on that.
Questions, comments?
Thank you, Carlo, for this beautiful summary. I first would like to say how much I enjoyed the conference. And during the conference, I was asking myself, this is a wonderfully diverse set of people and ideas. And is there, yes, there are division into, well, is something finite, is entity, do we use such or such method? I was thinking, what is it that could unite us? How could we express perhaps a common preoccupation that keeps all the people in this room not sleeping at night or whatever? Well, I could give you one comment. A few years ago, I was listening to David Gross, who proposed two big questions for the 21st century to answer. And he formulated them like that. The first question is, what particles are made of? Are they made of extended objects such as strings? And the second is that, what is space-time made of? What is sort of the way to understand the quantum degrees of freedom of space-time? I think trying to focus on this second question is what unifies really this whole conference.
Any comments on?
No, I agree. I fully agree.
If I can add a goal for the next conference, what keeps me up at night is issues about chirality and fermions. They've been hanging around for years and years and years. Do we have consistent coupling to chiral fermions? What's the relationship to the standard model chirality? Are there, as we saw in Kirill's talk, are there parity violating effects? Is the distinction between the chiral versions of the theory that we study and the non-chiral versions fundamental? All that collection, anomalies, all that collection of issues, I think we have the tools now to examine them and we should solve them.
Yes, I have a comment here. I could easily have added this in the list of interesting things, especially because issues related to that might show up in the CMB, which is a possibility. And there even are some hints that would might be disappearing soon, that at large distance there is some odd even. So.
Okay, last question.
I guess I want you to expand a little bit on general relativistic thermodynamics. I mean, we have Stewart and Israel and so forth in the 60s and so forth did general relativistic thermodynamics. What is it in this field that they didn't do that you would like to see better? I mean, is it understanding black hole thermodynamics, which is not clear, or what is the question that you're asking there?
Oh, thank you for this request of clarification. I think we have a fully satisfactory, I'm sure there are technical problems, controversy, but there is basically fully satisfactory understanding of thermodynamics on a curved space-time. I don't think there are big fundamental issues there. So you have an arbitrary curved space-time, and somebody would say there are open questions there, but that's in every field. But the foundations are pretty clear. But this is not the full story. Because this is like doing thermodynamics of a charged particle in a fixed electromagnetic field. Of course, we know that at least part of the heat is going to go to the electromagnetic field itself, so we need to consider the thermodynamics of the electromagnetic field itself, which is black body radiation, if you want. which is complicated because it requires quantum mechanics, otherwise it's infinite. So physically, I think there is an obvious problem, which is what is the statistical mechanics, not just of the degrees of freedom of matter on a gravitational field, but of the gravitational field themselves. What is the entropy of gravity in the sense in which what is the entropy of electromagnetic field, the one that we count if we, of course, again, we can take a background and gravitons, but we know this is an approximation which breaks down when the gravitational field is strong. So if I want to do statistical mechanics and thermodynamics of gravity itself, it has to be general covariant statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. And I rapidly ran into all sorts of difficulties, right? I want to write Boltzmann or Gibbs distribution function, rho e to the minus h, h is zero, so what am I doing? And so on and so forth. Now, I've had these questions for a long time, these are open, but they become crucial because I can teach you that if there is an acceleration, there is a temperature, and if there is a... if there is an horizon, there is a... Okay. So I think it became even more crucial because what we realized, I just was flying through that, is that in gravity, it's complicated to have local observables. So either we go to asymptotic observables, which we might not like for some reason, or we consider finite region of space-time and boundary observables, which is what we do in spin form. Now, with boundary observables, it turns out that we're always in a statistical situation, essentially because there are correlations around the corner, because to stay inside, one sees the Uru temperature, just to put it. So in a sense, there is no non-thermal limit of quantum gravity in the way we're doing that. This is vague, but I think I'm giving you the gist of what is.
Okay, let's thank Tugger again.
Thank you.
Okay. Next summary talk will be given by Abba Eisdeck.
You have this, right? Ooh.
So, I'm really going to talk mostly about the promising paths, so where not so much about personal thing about what keeps me awake, which I think was very, very nice discussion that we just had, but what we could be doing as a community for the next meeting, until the next meeting. And this title actually comes, as many of you know, from the Spanish poet, Antonio Machado, and sort of it says, traveler, there is no path. Paths are made by walking. And I think it goes on to say, a traveler, paths are but your footprints and nothing more. And as in other approaches in quantum gravity, I think we have made these paths by walking. In loop quantum gravity, as Kirill just reminded us, we started out by looking at general relativity as a generally covariant gauge theory in the Yang-Mills sense. Then there was a path which was developed, which had to do with specific theory of quantum geometry, and then its applications to cosmology, black holes, and spin forms that Carlo just mentioned. So in this particular, my own talk, what I'm going to do is to basically talk about issues that Carlo either did not focus on or just mentioned in passing, which is really the Hamiltonian theory, cosmology, the very early universe, and quantum black holes. And I'm not going to say anything about spin forms because Carlo already sort of covered that area, and our time is limited. So let me begin with the Hamiltonian or the canonical theory. So in loop quantum gravity, in fact, the kinematics, we have had complete control for a very long time. And there are novel and physically interesting effects of quantum geometry. But by contrast, the status of full dynamics in loop quantum gravity continues to remain unsatisfactory. And a powerful hint, as we heard in some talks, was to look for off-shell closure. So again, to remind everybody, the non-trivial problem is really that the points of bracket between the two Hamiltonian constraints, the diffeomorphism constraint, except that the shift which appears here is really a Q number shift in the sense that it depends on the dynamical variable, in this case just the metric. So it's not a Lie algebra. Now, advances were made in the 90s, seminal work by Thomas Tiemann particularly, which had to do with regularization of this particular Hamiltonian constraints. And then the question was, what about off-shell closure? The off-shell closure idea was really pursued by, as Madhavan explained to us, by Gambini, Lewandowski, Marolf, and Pullin. But both these issues have some unsatisfactory elements, as Madhavan reminded us. The Hamiltonian constraint that Thomas Tiemann gave us is really defined only on diffeomorphism in varying states. And secondly, in this off-shell closure, what happens is that the quantum version of the commutator here vanishes on the habitat, on the domain that was introduced by these authors, and the left-hand side also vanishes. So it is true that there is no anomaly, but somehow one seems it is sort of clear impression that this is an overkill. There's something too strong that one is actually imposing mathematically. And this has been sort of the status for a long time. But I think since loops 11, we have seen quite an interesting and technically as well as conceptually novel ideas that were put forward, almost all by these four authors, Alok Ladda, Madhavan Varadarajan, Tom Casey, and Adam Henderson. And the important thing here was the following, that if you look at this right-hand side, the important thing here is that this is a diffeomorphism which is generated by Q number shift. And we really hadn't paid much attention to diffeomorphisms generated by Q number shift. We just looked at the diffeomorphism group, we looked at the spin networks and sort of quotiented out, and that was a very nice construction. But what really we need to do, grapple with, is this Q number shift up here. And the second big realization is that, in fact, there are elementary Q number shifts, which I'm going to call EQNS, just elementary Q number shifts, which are given by taking a lapse and multiplying it with a shift, multiplying with a trial. So, but of course, this, you don't get a single shift vector, but you get three of these shift vectors. But these, the realization was that if understanding the diffeomorphism constraint smeared with this Q number shift is quite of very interesting and leads to interesting developments. So why is this the case? Well, there are two different issues here. One is a very old one. This was the following. When the connection variables were introduced, actually they were introduced using spinorial variables, and then it was all forgotten, and the spinorial variables are not coming back again. And in terms of the spinorial variables, in fact, the four constraints, the diffeomorphism and the Hamiltonian constraint, I'm just for simplicity, I'm only talking about the Euclidean sector, if you like, or I'm using self-dual connections in this whole part of the talk. So these constraints actually naturally combine into a constraint which looks like E. So E has a spinorial indices, B has a spinorial indices, internal indices, and F has a spinorial indices. And so therefore, you just multiply those matrices, if you like, and then finally you get two spinorial indices. And this is neither symmetric nor antisymmetric, so we're left with four constraints, and these constraints are actually in code diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint. If you trace over it, or if you contract with epsilon spinner, then you get the Hamiltonian constraint. If you symmetrize them, then you get the diffeomorphism constraint. So this suggests that both these constraints should be treated in the same manner. And this is something that was not done before. And indeed, this is also known that indeed we can represent the Hamiltonian constraint. Now I'm using the standard notation, not the spinorial notation, but the more familiar notation. So if you think about it, you've got E contracted with F. So it is in some moral sense, a rough sense, this looks like a diffeomorphism thing. This looks like a Q number shift, the elementary Q number shift that we have. Except that this really is somewhat twisted because I have here an epsilon, which is actually, for the real diffeomorphism constraint, these two indices will be contracted, J and K. But here I got an epsilon tensor there. So, but this constraint, because of this form, actually generates a twisted diffeomorphism, the diffeomorphism whose shift is an elementary Q number shift. Namely, for example, the Hamiltonian constraint, its Poisson bracket with A is just given by exactly the Lie derivative here by this Q number shift of A, except that there is this twist. This twist is epsilon ijk. And similarly, the expression for E is very similar to this. It's a little more complicated, but it's very similar to this. So the key message here is that action of the Hamiltonian constraint is geometric in the connection variables. I think in this talk, Enrique on shape dynamics emphasized how the Hamiltonian constraint is so completely different. And certainly, if you use the York-Lichnerowitz equation, then the Hamiltonian constraint is completely different from the diffeomorphism constraint. But in fact, in the connection variables, they are rather close to each other. And there was a brand new insight that came in the last 2 years, and that was that the Poisson bracket between two Hamiltonian constraints is, in fact, is the same as sum of Poisson brackets between diffeomorphism constraints. So this is really the elementary shift which is defined by this. So basically, by this formula, you take m times e, and that's why you've got three of them. Similarly, n times e, you've got three of them, and then you sum all of them. So the brand new insight was that this Poisson bracket, which has been troubling us, is in fact can be written as a sum of the Poisson bracket of diffeomorphism constraints with Q number elementary Q number shifts. And therefore, the problem is now focused on understanding the action of the twisted diffeomorphisms, or ordinary diffeomorphisms, with these elementary Q number shifts, or the twisted diffeomorphisms, on quantum states. And this is an entirely new perspective on the conceptual level on the Hamiltonian constraint. The technical work that Madhavan presented us was done in a simplified theory in which SU2 was replaced by U1 cube. But Madhavan himself and Alok are working using SU2 in mind, and Alok has written down the theory almost completely for SU2. So this, I think, is not a very strong restriction. The fact that it's Euclidean is a strong restriction, but there are ideas about that. And what they did was to show that careful regularization, which, as Madhavan explained, requires specific choice of density weights, it shows that there is a precise sense in which one has off-shell closure, namely the Hamiltonian constraint, the quantum Hamiltonian constraint, with the quantum Hamiltonian constraint, this commutator, which is regularized in some way that he mentioned, and you take the regulator away, you get some operator that is equal to summation over I of the commutator between these diffeomorphism constraints. So basically, there are really no anomalies. There is off-shell closure, and the algebra is faithfully mirrored in the quantum theory. The important thing now is that neither side vanishes, and in fact, there is a geometrical action of these sides that is sort of pleasing and understandable. And furthermore, one does not have to solve the standard diffeomorphism constraint to define the Hamiltonian constraint. And further, finally, the covariance of the construction, of the regularization scheme, greatly reduces the freedom in the choice of the auxiliary structure. That was always troubling me, has always troubled me, that in the Tiemann regularization, for example, one has to use all kinds of auxiliary structures, and if I change the auxiliary structure, I get some other quantum operator. And then the question is, and this is okay if I understood the physical meaning of the choices that of the auxiliary structure that I'm making, but this was never clear. So reduction of this arbitrariness, I think, is a huge progress. So what are the promising paths here? First is to extend quantum theory from U1 cube to SU2, and I think this is going to be done very soon. Then more important thing is to introduce a physical inner product on the space of solutions to the constraints. This is something that was done in three-dimensional theory by the similar techniques, but four dimensions one does not have sort of great ideas so far. So this, to me, is an outstanding problem to extract physics. And to extract physics from the solutions, we need this inner product. But another possibility is to use matter fields as clocks to make, and this is an idea that we heard in many talks, to make this H hat a true Hamiltonian. And then the action of this operator is geometric. It creates new vertices. One understands intuitively what is happening. I don't want to say that every problem that one had in mind is solved, but I think there's a very promising direction up here. And finally, one would like to, it would be nice to develop approximation methods to particularly develop reliable, effective equations coming from here to systematically, because one has this operator algebra. Now, there is a very nice development in the last few years, which was to try to get these effective equations in loop quantum gravity by first making an educated guess as to how the classical constraint functions, the Hamiltonian constraint function, the diffeomorphism constraint function, would be modified by small quantum corrections, and then asking that the new objects, that these modified generators of Hamilton, Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraint, their Poinsot algebra should close. But that led to a Poinsot algebra, at least sometimes it leads to a Poinsot algebra, which is distinct from the classic, from the general relativity Poinsot algebra. But now here we see that, in fact, the general relativity Poinsot algebra is completely faithfully carried over to the full quantum theory. Therefore, there is a tension between the two ideas. And therefore, it will be important to develop the reliable, effective equations in a very systematic way to see what is going on. So this is the first part of the talk. The second part is cosmology. I do continue to believe that cosmology is a great window for us, because for any approach in quantum gravity, because if we are going to have any sort of quantum gravity effects that are going to be seen, most likely they will first come from cosmology. In fact, people, cosmologists who work on early universe, like to say very strongly that we already have seen the quantum gravity effects. By that, what they mean is, you look at the perturbations, these perturbations are treated as quantum fields, which are in some Bunch-Davis-like vacuum state in the inflationary scenario. But even in non-inflationary scenarios, the perturbations are treated quantum mechanically, and these include the metric perturbations, and therefore, seeing the CMB coming out correctly, for example, from inflationary scenario, is some evidence of quantum gravity. But what we'd like to do is to get more evidence about beyond the perturbative domain, about the quantum nature of geometry itself, for example, how the bounce affects this whole picture and so on. And since loop 11, really the following thing has happened. Before loops 11, the main emphasis was on singularity resolution and on possible effects of quantum gravity during inflation. I think it was realized that these effects are going to be totally negligible, and therefore the attention has been focused now on the pre-inflationary dynamics. There are several groups discussing this, and we heard talks from the French group. Heard the talk from the Madrid group, and we heard the talk from the Penn State group on these ideas. Now, there are differences in what is happening in detail. But there's a broad picture that is emerging. And since my time is limited, I could not tell you all the three aspects, so to say. So I'm going to focus on one that was given to us by Ivan. Namely, that the emerging picture is the following. First of all, there is this new parameter, which is really the value of the inflaton at the bounce, or at some other natural time in the Planck regime, for example, at the end of the superinflation, where the matter density is half of that at the bounce. The next thing is that almost all initial data at the bounce enter a slow roll inflation compatible with seven-year WMAP data within its error bars. So this is very nice that we understand that we could put, for the background geometry, we could put in kind of generic initial conditions, and they will lead us to the WMAP data, to the slow roll compatible with the WMAP data. Then the next thing is that in the inflationary scenario, the observable universe is tiny in the Planck regime, right? Now here, we can see how much it is at the bounds. And the observable universe, which is now a few gigaparsecs, that all originated from a ball of less than 10 Planck length, or around 10 Planck length. So it's a tiny ball. And therefore, in some sense, the burden of showing or are accounting for the extraordinary homogeneity and isotropy of the universe reduces to understanding why initial conditions on this tiny ball are so extraordinarily homogeneous and isotropic. Now, inflationary people have said this for a very long time. But as we know, there have been severe criticisms of this, for example, from Roger Penrose, because we still need quite a lot of fine-tuning as to how did it happen? How was this homogeneity and isotropy achieved in this tiny ball? There is a new mechanism in loop quantum gravity, and the new element is this repulsive force of quantum geometry origin, which dilutes these inhomogeneities precisely at this scale up here. So therefore, there is hope now of obtaining some natural initial conditions, which are almost, homogeneous and isotropic, up to the inevitable quantum fluctuations that Heisenberg principle forces upon us. So there is some hope of actually arriving at these initial conditions, these precise initial conditions that we might need from loop quantum gravity. And finally, if phi bounds is greater than some parameter value, there is a self-consistent completion of the inflationary scenario. But for foreseeable future, we would not see many deviations from the inflationary scenario. On the other hand, if phi bounds is less than that, then there is potential for new physics. So this is the scenario that is coming up. And what we would like to know now do is, what should we be doing in the future? So I think that the first interesting path is really we need to understand this regime in which there is potential for new physics much, much more detail than it has been done so far by any of the three groups. I mean, first of all, this calculation of the back reaction, one assumes everything is coming from perturbations, but is a back reaction controlled completely in this regime? We know that if phi b is bigger than 1.2, that the back reaction is controlled. But so far, we do not have a conclusive proof that if phi b is bigger than this, if phi b is less than 1.2, then the back reaction is controlled. Secondly, if phi b is less than 1.2 Planck mass, then at the onset of inflation, the state is not a Bunch-Davies vacuum. But it is not hugely different from it, but still it's not Bunch-Davies vacuum. But because of the standard inflationary calculations are based, assuming the state is in Bunch-Davies vacuum, so one has to sort of redo the whole calculations using this code, CMB FAST, for if phi b is bigger than 1.2, then the state is so close to the Bunch-Davies vacuum that we don't have to do that. But if it is less than we have to do that. So that would be very good. And we should carefully calculate, for example, three-point functions and potential for non-Gaussianities to arrive at the thing that Carlo wanted, that maybe this actually predicts that there must be non-Gaussianities which are bigger than what Planck has told us, and then it will be ruled out. But again, it is like real physics. That is, it's not a yes-no prediction. You restrict or you understand this parameter space. Now, this parameter space is very small, but on the other hand, if one did find an effect which is compatible with this, then that would be great, because then one could go much, much more detail and explore that parameter space in real depth. Second thing is the initial state of the bounds, or at the end of superinflation. We need some new principle, and one of the things that has been explored in detail is a generalization, a quantum version of Penrose's wild curvature hypothesis, which will restrict the initial data for perturbations at the bounds or at the end of superinflation at some natural time in the Planck regime. The important, to me, a key thing is to know if, in fact, this repulsive force from loop quantum gravity that comes up, from loop quantum geometry that comes up, can it actually lead us to these desired initial conditions with minimal fluctuations about homogeneity and isotropy? And this, I think, to make it precise, would be very, very, very valuable. And finally, people are already doing it. I think Ed Wilson talked about this, about analyze the alternatives to inflation using loop quantum gravity. Now, I think in this case, there is a criticism that comes very strongly from cosmologists. They say that quantum gravity people are experts in navel gazing, you know, looking just at your own navel, not ignoring the rest of the world. And to some extent, I think this criticism is right. We are always solving internal problems. So I think it is important to really be aggressive and do calculations ahead of the future observations. Now, Planck is going to release some observations in the near future, but that's not going to be the end of the story, because, for example, correlations between the three-point functions and such things, these correlation functions, there are also missions, such as the Sloan mission, Sloan 4, that is going to measure the galaxy-galaxy correlation functions, three-point, four-point, et cetera, rather accurately. And then these correlation functions, of course, came from something in CMB, and therefore they are going to tell us something about CMB, although we're not directly by looking at CMB, but indirectly. And therefore, I think it is important to actually do these calculations up here. Now, the key thing I think we learned from Planck is what Carlo also emphasized, is that nature is much simpler than one might imagine. And this is something that we seem to be learning a lot over the past decade. We learned it in the black hole collision problem in classical general relativity. Very eminent leading people thought that this process in the strong, when they are very close, would be very complicated. The spins would flip, the black holes might do very crazy things before they merge, and that would create enormous complications. The radiation will be complicated. The numerical relativity people actually were finally able to solve the problem and found that the nature is too simple in some sense. You know, none of these things happen. We are reminded of this again by the quantum evaporation process by Bill, that one would imagine, well, these ultraviolet problems, I mean, why should we trust this simple picture that came out of Hawking calculation? And this is, again, turned out to be very simple. So we should not sort of keep worrying about, oh, all kinds of complications would happen, et cetera, et cetera. Somehow the states that are chosen by nature seem to be such that many of these potential complications, which we do want to understand, but they are actually avoided in the real world. So I just want to emphasize this, that this is not something that, only quantum gravity people are telling other quantum gravity people. I mean, certainly the people working on Planck have been really telling us explicitly that, in fact, there are these anomalies, these hemispherical anomalies, namely the southern hemisphere is slightly hotter than the northern hemisphere. And as Carlo pointed out, there are issues that are open because of large error bars at the large angular scales or the small L scales that are open up here. And this is a quote from, at the Planck press conference, this is a quote from Gosky from the United States, namely, puzzles raised by large-scale anisotropies, they first try to fit with the Bianchi models, they reduce this anomaly, but then they cause problems at the large L or the small angular scales. The way that Planck has worked is, it's really a six-parameter fitting. It's really six-parameter fitting that one is trying to do. And this fitting is done by looking at large L or small angular scale, and then in the model, those parameters are chosen, and then predictions are made for large angular scales. And here, then, there is a problem. And George Efstathiou was, in fact, even more explicit in his conference, saying explicitly that there may be new physics in this region, and then therefore people doing quantum gravity, encouraging people for quantum gravity, to see if in fact there is some remnant of pre-inflationary dynamics in there. So I think this is something that we should do. Now again, these are not huge effects, I should say. These are 3 sigma effects and so on. But again, we have to be ahead of the curve. We have to sort of understand theoretically, not wait until the effect is completely confirmed experimentally, and then try to explain it. Okay. So, but this is all of the phenomenological side, but I think on the fundamental side, we should keep in mind that these are only models, and these models are shortcuts. I feel that the situation is a little like the Dirac model of the hydrogen atom. See, Dirac comes and says, okay, you want to do the hydrogen atom? Fine. First, assume spherical symmetry. Of course, if you assume spherical symmetry, there are no photons. But then you saw the energy levels and everything. The model is conceptually very wrong. There are no photons. But it works extremely well until we have come to lamp shift, when these effects of the quantum field theory effects become important. I feel that it's likely to be the case that once the work that is being begun now crystallizes, those predictions are going to be valid. But that doesn't mean that the theory is fundamentally correct. It's just that one has found nice approximations, nice truncations to get what one needs for the observations. But at a fundamental level, we still want to do this. And therefore, it is very important to connect with the full quantum theory. And we heard this in Jonathan Ingalls' talk. Now, in the Hamiltonian theory, I think a good direction would be to apply this Varadarajan-Ladda framework to Bianchi-1 models. There are mutual benefits. One would strengthen one's understanding of quantum cosmology, but one would also get intuition for the full quantum gravity. And for spin forms, there are the new directions recently opened by using GFT, and we heard about it in the talks by Gillen, Oriti, and Sindoni in this conference. Okay, let me just come with the final part, which has to do with quantum black holes. And I can be a little bit rapid here because Carlo already talked about it. Basically, there were advances in the 2000s, and these advances came about by looking at the sector of general relativity representing a black hole in equilibrium, which is modeled by isolated horizons. And then the nice thing was that one had a good control understanding of the quantum geometry of these isolated horizons, and people used very advanced number theory techniques to calculate the number of microstates. The positive thing about this is really that there's a precise notion of a quantum isolated horizon, not just classical but quantum. Namely, the surface, at the surface, some operator equation actually holds. So the state must satisfy some equation, must be annihilated by some operator, which encapsulates the idea that this is not a random surface, but this is an isolated horizon. But the problem was that basically this was all done, and the calculation remained pristine, and there was nothing, no physics, so to say, beyond counting came out of it, because there was no contact with semi-classical physics. So the area has remained rather barren. And as Carlo emphasized, there really has been a breath of fresh air since Loops 11. There's a big shift. We heard about it in the Perez and Bianchi talks. Now, new ideas of Rindler horizon, boost-killing vector field, effective quantum gravity, low-energy phenomena, focusing on just low-energy phenomena, and then the idea of entanglement in entropy, and focusing on the changes of the horizon entropy versus the entropy itself. These all have been extremely nice because we understand now this missing bridge. So basically, the picture is the following. The promising path is just this, right? This was the Planck scale understanding of the isolated quantum horizons, and this little L is coming up here. Hoping to help this in order to make the field very fertile and everything. And the relation between the non-perturbative LQG and these fascinating semi-classical advances, which we heard in these talks, as well as Yasha Niemann's talks, these are something that really had to be understood much, much better. More precisely, currently I believe, I'm not as enthusiastic about Carlo, about where we are. I believe that there are many, many problems at the moment. Currently, there is a real tension between the two. I just give a few examples because of time. In the semi-classical discussions, is the horizon necessary? This is a question that Laurent raised after Alejandro's talk. Is the horizon even necessary? What is the ensemble whose entropy is being calculated? To me, it is not clear. The quantum horizon boundary condition, which are so nice because it told us what a quantum black hole was, plays no role at all in these discussions. What would be the role of the near-horizon stationary observer at a distance L that is critically used everywhere in full loop quantum gravity? I have no idea. I have no understanding about how one is going to join those two things together. And that is why, in the previous picture up here, you know, there is a gap here. They're not really meeting. So I think that these tensions are always healthy, because that is what drives progress. But we need to fully recognize this tension and not just be sort of happy with the semi-classical pictures. And we would like to, and we must resolve this tension between the fundamental statistical mechanics counting and the Planck scale physics on the one hand, and the thermodynamic and semi-classical ideas, effective field theory ideas on otherwise. If we don't do this, I feel that there's a real danger of a swamp of muddled ideas, and I personally feel that this swamp is already developing. So I think we really need clarity to remove this swamp at this stage. But on the other hand, if this tension can be resolved, and my great hope is that this will be, then there will be big dividends well beyond loop quantum gravity. I mean, just for quantum gravity as a whole. I think this is a big dividend item up here. So finally, this is my last transparency. I feel that particularly to young people, I think what one needs and what one lacks in loop quantum gravity and perhaps in other quantum gravity circles also, is that one is too much inward bound. We need to be outward bound. I mean, for example, in loop quantum gravity, there is a tension between people who do formal calculations, who are mathematically very precise, and people who do phenomenology, and so on and so forth. I mean, there is almost not paying attention to each other, not taking each other very seriously, and this has to really go away. The tension with the, we need a better balance and harmony between levels of precision, people who do very, very precise things, and people who do heuristics in various sub-areas. And these are sort of really divide sub-areas in some ways, and it will be nice if they talk to each other much, much more. Younger researchers need to interact much more with other areas of physics, mathematics, and cosmology. And can we make non-trivial advances on issues that they are interested in? I mean, I think 90% of the time, we're always solving internal problems, you know, within ourselves. Something that doesn't work in spin forms, or doesn't work in regularizing the Hamiltonian constraint, or black hole entropy, then you know, how do you do it or something? But we should see what the rest of the world, particularly the broader physics community, is most interested in, and try to solve at least some of those problems. And better yet, if we can solve any of their problems that they could not solve using these techniques, that would be very, very nice. And we saw some ideas along these lines in this conference, but I think this is really important. Now, at LOOPS conferences, we all have had talks from other areas. At this conference, we have had representation from asymptotic safety, CDT, cosets, phenomenology, quantum field theory in curved space-time, analog systems, quantum information, and so on. For loop quantum gravity, I think this cross-fertilization is essential, and I hope that experts in other areas also agree with this, and we will continue to interact and reciprocate with this the initiative that loop quantum gravity takes in its own conferences. Thank you very much.
In one of the first transparencies, you mentioned that we have a problem with scalar products for physical states. I think that we don't have problem. We have examples of full quantization when we can define this physical. So I understand that you have new hope that this new idea which Madaman presented may lead us to something new. We may have some new insight about new kind of physical.
I was really referring to the need to introduce the physical linear product. I mean, when I talked about physical linear product, it was explicitly in the context of the new regularization with the proper closure and so on. So on that space of those solutions, I would like to have, it would be nice to have the scalar product. And also, again, scalar product is only one step. Having a scalar product and saying, here's my quantum gravity theory, I have solved it. I mean, nobody's going to believe it if you don't have any physical predictions. So I think we also need to extract physical predictions.
And the second comment is that this new result which Madhavan presented to us, this new understanding of relation between the scalar constraint on one hand and the vector constraint is possible only due to your variables. So in the usual IDM variables, we don't see it. So now we are really taking advantage of those connection
right.
Variables and tetrad variables. So there's really something deeper in those variables.
That's very right. And the interesting thing is that this was actually the first part of the transparency was actually worked out. And Joe Romano, who was a student at that time, so this was in the early 90s, this part of this idea that the whole, this was known at the very beginning, and we tried to actually work directly with this constraint, and it was not very successful in terms of at that time. So I think this taking up this new idea, which is the second thing up here, was very, very interesting. Steve.
So I have a question about your arguments about inflation and loop quantum cosmology. I mean, this is, there's an old argument of Alice's that says, take any present universe with a CMB spectrum that's inconsistent with WMAP, evolve it backwards, in your case, say, to the bounce, there'll be something there. So to say that the physics at the bounce predicts a spectrum now you must be making some assumptions about some probability measure of conditions at the bounce. Can you say what that is?
Yeah. So there are two issues. The way that is all done is by looking at the background geometry and the perturbations. And they're both quantized. And as Ivan explained, the perturbations, quantum fields perturbations, are propagating on this background geometry. On the background geometry, the assumption is that at the bounce, the state is sharply peaked at some, you know, it's sharply peaked at some value of the observables, that the phase space variables that you have got up here. And the point at which it's sharply peaked is very generic. Basically, the parameter space one has goes from 0 to about 1,000,000, and you have to exclude 0 to 1, roughly. It can be peaked anywhere here. So in that sense, it is very weak. But sharply peaked is an input. And for the perturbations, the idea is that these perturbations at the bounce, the initial condition, should be, because the background state is homogeneous isotropic, therefore we're looking for regular fourth order adiabatic quantum states, which are also isotropic and homogeneous at the bounce up here. And then the idea is that, furthermore, this is the quantum wild curvature hypothesis, that the uncertainty in the electric part of the wild tensor and the magnetic part of the wild tensor, they are minimum possible. This is like saying the wild curvature, the background is zero, and this should, but compatible with the uncertainty principle up here. So this is the input that is done. In the numerical evolution then, four such states were taken, they've evolved, and we found that there was no such thing. So you would have to put, to get something different, one would have to put something which is which has a lot of particles, which does not violate this quantum version of wild curvature hypothesis.
By the technical question, in this construction of this version of the Hamiltonian operator, reminds me an heuristic construction of the sort of early days of LQG, which has a very similar geometrical action, which was a shift operator. Did you look if there is any relation or not? Did you?
But this is a Q number shift operator, right? I mean, it's not a. So there was a thing like that with the shift. Okay, I think Madhavan can answer the question if he's in the audience. Please, Madhavan is there.
So two things. One is, of course, if you put in Hilbert space norms, etc., then how this shift of operator acts in the terms you neglect, etc., and if you put in the Hilbert norms, those are, one has to re-examine that. But what is really nice is that there is this really beautiful paper by Bernie before he kind of exited LQG and did this numerical relativity stuff, where he actually computes the constraint algebra, and he uses things like the shift operator. And the beautiful thing about that calculation is, you see, in comparison to U1 cubed, when you go to SU2, you're going to have these insertions with Pauli matrices, etc. And technically, what he nicely does is he kind of moves all these Pauli matrix insertions and makes their role kind of independent of the rest of the stuff. So it provides a very nice skeleton, as many of these heuristic, I'm not saying in a negative way, many of these early ideas, they provide skeletons for what exactly to do and how to make it precise. And in this case, I think what I would do personally is to look at, what I want to do is to really look carefully at Bernie's paper and try and make it more precise now using, you know, a lot of other ideas.
Okay, so it's the time limit. So let's thank again both Abai and Carol for the wonderful internal summary.
Quick announcements first. I'm just before people, the official final closing comes up. The next Loops conference will be in Erlangen in 2 years from now, and I think they have prepared a very nice closing ceremony. But No, but of course, in this closing ceremony, we will not thank Lee, Laura, and Bianca, who were the prime organizers scientifically and otherwise behind all this thing. This has been such a wonderful conference, so we should thank them, you know, profoundly.
Thank you. And let's bring all the organizers up, all the session organizers. Come on down. While they're coming down, we should make some official thanks. We should also make an announcement. The 6 p.m. thing on the program for a closing ceremony is right now, so we don't have to come back here at 6 p.m. Well, we should thank again for funding the Institute for Particle Physics, that's a Canadian institute, the John Templeton Foundation, and the University of Waterloo, especially the math department. I want to thank personally everybody here. Enormous work was done by our session organizers and our local organizing committee, and I think they all deserve a round of applause.
I want to comment on what Abai says. I want to correct what he says. You should blame us for what, you know, for everything that went wrong in this conference, but you should thank them for everything that went right in this conference, because the scientific organization of every separate session is a humongous headache and requires more than you can, you know, explain managing and choosing and discussion. So, you know, that's really, I don't know, where the work was. Scientifically.
Well, the last scientific part, we had a scientific advisory committee, many members of which are here, and which we took enormous advice and guidance from. So we'd like to thank the advisory committee. Thank you. And now, as I'm sure some people have noticed, everything here at Perimeter Institute, all the things that work because of our fantastic staff. Our IT staff, our bistro staff, our facilities staff, our travel staff that got everybody here and out. And Bianca, I think, has some things to say specifically.
Yeah, so let me thank the scientific staff, the administration staff. The story is, as you know, that this somehow the first conference which was sold out. So thank you all for coming. We had lots of discussions and learned lots of new things. So being, of course, sold out very early brought us many problems which were amazingly solved by Stephanie and Amanda for us. Thank you, sir. Of course, you might have noticed you got food. And it was amazingly good food. And again, the problem is we had 200 people more in the building, which is lots more people than usually are. So let's thank the bistro staff. Having had some other conferences, it's usually, you know, a pain to tape and to all talks and so on. And here we had, if you didn't notice, you can basically already listen and view your own performances and all other talks, which is, of course, important since we had 4 parallel sessions. And this is due to the audio and visual stuff. Thank you.
Last, let me mention that there was also a big organizational thing, basically to help certain people with finances and invite people as visitors and all the plenary speakers. And as always, we have our great Karen here, which always books everything for us and gives you all the apartments. So let's thank Karen. And the special thanks goes to Florian, because he helped us getting more money from the many mass departments, I think there are two, at the University of Waterloo, and also helped us a lot with the plenary session and the financial decisions and so on. So let's thank Florian.
And you know, because I'm totally objective and as I'm absolutely not biased on you know what happened there as a totally external observer, I would like to thank all the plenary speakers and all the parallel session, because in my view this has been the most exciting Loop conference I've been to.
The very last thanks goes to all of you, the researchers in quantum gravity and loop quantum gravity who have made this such a fantastic several years, for all the results reported here, for all the discussions and conversations and excitement. Thank you very much for coming, and see you at Erlangen in 2 years, and I'm sure very often you're all welcome back here many times before.